Greetings, Darklings. This is DJ Datura from Incantation, and you are listening to Mr. Dark's Audio Nasty.
And now, Roma Wines, R-O-M-A, Roma Wines, present...
Suspense. Tonight, Roma Wines bring you Robert Taylor in The House in Cypress Canyon, a suspense play produced, edited, and directed for Roma Wines by William Spear.
Suspense. Radio's outstanding theater of thrills is presented for your enjoyment by Roma Wines. That's R-O-M-A, Roma Wines. Those better-tasting California wines enjoyed by more Americans than any other wine. For friendly entertaining, for delightful dining. Yes, right now, a glassful would be very pleasant as Roma Wines bring you Robert Taylor, star of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Undercurrent, in a remarkable tale of...
Suspense!
Merry Christmas, Jerry. How's the real estate business?
Kind of early with your greeting, aren't you, Sam?
Well, I got to get them in sometime. I may not see you again until next Christmas.
If this real estate racket gets any crazy, I'll be dead by next Christmas. I'm glad you could get up here, though, Sam.
What's on your mind, Jerry?
You'll probably shoot me when you hear it, Sam, because I'm probably nuts. But doggone it, you're a detective and you're my pal, and I just had to tell somebody.
Well, you sound like it's serious.
That's just it. I don't know what it is, Sam, but... Now, listen, you know we're agents for a group of houses up in Cypress Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
Those places that were started before the war never got finished.
Oh, yeah.
All I got in were the foundations, just concrete and a couple of beams. Well, they've been finished now. In fact, I'm putting up the for rent on the last of them today.
What do you want? Police protection from the mob?
Listen, Sam, this house that I'm talking about, it's got a number now, 2256. But before, when the men went back to work on it about 3 months ago, well, they just started when the foreman on the job brought me a shoebox that he'd found up on a beam. And this box had a manuscript in it, a story, kind of, all written out.
Yeah.
Well, he gave me the thing. I read it. I didn't think much about it. I put it in my desk. But the other day, and I happened to drive by there, I saw the number on the house and what the house looked like. I thought of this manuscript. And, well, I don't like it, that's all. There's something funny about it.
What's funny about it?
Well, mind you, this thing was found in an unfinished house in Cypress Canyon. House was only just started building.
All right.
Well, listen, Sam, I want to read it to you if you got the time, and you'll see what I mean.
All right, shoot.
Well, here's how it begins. To whom it may concern, my reasons for setting down on paper what follows here will be abundantly clear.
What follows here will be abundantly clear to anyone into whose possession it may fall. First, let me say that I'm a very ordinary person. My name is James A. Woods. I'm 35 years old. By profession, a chemical engineer. My wife, Ellen, was a school teacher when I met and married her in Indiana 7 years ago. There's nothing in the past life of either one of us to suggest remotely any cause or reason for the dreadful thing that has invaded our lives. Our married life has been in no way different from that of millions of other average, reasonably happy, and congenial families. 3 months ago, I was ordered by my firm to take charge of a rather minor project in Los Angeles, Hollywood to be exact. The order was a sudden one. There'd been no time to secure accommodations, and conditions being what they are, the inevitable result was that until day before yesterday, we'd been living in the cramped quarters of one of those characteristic California motels. Needless to say, most of our spare time had been devoted to a search for something more permanent and comfortable, but the fruits of these efforts had been, financially and in every other way, a geometrical progression of discouragement. Until last Saturday afternoon, only 4 days before Christmas, we were driving into town on our way to a movie when Ellen saw it.
Jim, look!
What?
That sign in front of that real estate office.
Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah.
Don't you see what it says? For rent, furnished, two-bedroom house, close in, immediate occupancy.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Aren't you going to stop?
Oh, Ellen, you know what a sign like that. It means right out in plain sight in front of a real estate office.
Oh, yeah, but Jim...
Either they want $600 a month...
We'll never know until we ask.
If it's any good at all, there are probably 50 people fighting for it right back there now.
Well, honey, there's no harm in trying. Now, is there?
You really want to go back?
Oh, it's probably foolish, but what can we lose?
Okay.
Oh, darling, come on, cheer up. How do you know? Maybe our luck's changed. Maybe fate's going to give us a nice new house for a Christmas present.
Come in.
Oh, we're sorry to bother you, but we just happened to see that for rent sign outside.
Oh, yeah, I hung it outside just this minute.
Is the house available?
Why, sure it is.
Let me introduce myself. My name is James A. Woods, and this is my wife, Ellen.
How to do? Wow, looks like it's fixing to rain.
Yes, so it does, doesn't it? Well, it was one of those things. The real estate agent had just been authorized to rent the place by mail that morning, and he'd hardly had time to look at it himself and put up his sign when we drove up. It was just an ordinary little California house about halfway up Cypress Canyon, number 2256. Just an ordinary, undistinguished little house. The agent didn't know much about it. Construction on it had been stopped by the war, and it had just been completed and furnished lately. Been vacant while somebody's estate was being settled, and now it was owned by a bank in Sacramento. Of course, we didn't
care about it. Got this key in the mail along with the authorization to rent. Only one there is. Of course, you can have duplicates made. Yeah, seems to stick a little. Oh, no, there it is.
Doesn't sound as though that door had ever been opened.
Well, a little oil on the hinges will fix that, all right.
Oh, sure.
Now here's your living room. Furniture's a little dusty, of course. You got to expect that. It's good furniture, though, you see? Benson Brothers.
Yes,
Now, over here's a little den. Paneled, you see? Radio, fireplace. Really a very attractive little room, particularly for a man.
Uh-huh, yep.
Now, the bedroom's off the living room here. Everything's all on one floor, you understand?
Uh-huh.
It's quite nice, I think.
Yes, uh-huh.
You can see you get the morning sun here. There's a view of the canyon through these front windows. We got cross ventilation.
That's about all there was to it. It wasn't the best place in the world. It was small and badly built, but what would you have done? We took it with as little inspection as that. It was the Saturday before Christmas. And the very same evening, we were struggling up the steps from the road with suitcases and boxes and armloads of clothes and all the endless bric-a-brac that people collect and never know they have until they move. Ellen began unpacking, and I began moving things around and taking the worst of the pictures off the wall, doing all the little things that everybody does when they move into a new place and try to give it something of their own.
Don't be such a sourpuss. You know, it's a roof over our heads for Christmas. That's more than we ever thought we'd get, isn't it? Now, what in the world are we going to do with those two pictures?
Why don't we just leave them where they are?
Jim, we can't. They're too awful.
Well, all right, put them in the closet then.
I can't. Both the closets are jammed full.
No, I mean the other one in the little alcove off the den. At least there's a door there. I suppose it's a closet. Yeah. I don't know.
That isn't a commentary on the housing problem, huh? A woman moving into a house without even knowing where all the closets are. Take the pictures down, will you, honey? Bring them in here.
Okay.
Oh, I guess you'll have to help me with this door. I can't get it open.
Let me see it. Well, of course you can, silly. It's locked. Where are those keys we found on the desk?
Here they are.
Nope. Not this one. Sure, this one won't work. Nope. Feels like an awful solid door for a closet.
Oh, and that's one solid door in the house.
Nope, this one won't do it either. Well, we'll just have to get a locksmith up here on Monday. I'll put the pictures behind the desk, okay?
Yeah, all right. Jim, if you could just help me move this armchair, huh?
Oh, Ellen, will you let it go until tomorrow? You know what time it is?
Oh, but, honey, I'd like to get the place looking just a little
bit. Yeah, but it's almost midnight. In fact, it's exactly...
What was that?
Tomcat, I guess, out in the brush somewhere.
Sounded near. Hope that doesn't go on all night.
Well, there's much we can do about it. Come on, Ellen. I'm dead tired.
All right, Jim. All right.
Where'd you put the toothpaste, honey?
It's right in the medicine cabinet.
Oh, yeah.
Jim, we ought to get some firewood tomorrow. You know, a fire in that living room would make all the difference in the world.
Can't. Sunday.
Well, Monday, then. Jim, I think red curtains are what we need, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just at least for the living room. Anyway, the ones in there now have just got to come down.
Yeah, I suppose they do.
What do you think of red?
Well, I guess it's all...
Jim.
That's some tomcat.
Jim, it sounded in the house.
Well, how could it be in the house, Ellen? We've been over every inch of the house.
Except the closet.
Now, how could a cat or anything else be in the closet that's been locked up for over a year?
I don't know.
It's probably under the house. A wildcat or mountain lion or something. I hear they have them in California.
Jim, I don't like
it. Well, neither do I like it, but there's nothing we can do about it tonight.
Well, maybe we ought to call somebody, the police or some neighbor.
Oh, don't be silly, Ellen. You act like a kid. Come on, let's go to bed, huh?
Well, all right. I suppose it is silly. Jimmy, did you lock the door?
Yeah. Can I turn out the lights now?
Yeah. All right.
Good night, Ellen. Sleep tight.
Good night, Jim.
I don't know what time it was, perhaps an hour, perhaps only a half hour later. My mind was in that hazy borderland between sleep and a dream that's still part of consciousness. Then I was awake. Ellen, are you all right?
Yes.
Did you have a nightmare or something?
No. I heard it too.
Well, that didn't sound like any cat.
Put on the light.
Yeah.
It seemed to be out there, Jim, in the house somewhere.
I'm going to look into this.
Jim, you be careful.
Come on. Where's my shotgun?
In the den, I think. Jim.
What?
There's something wet.
What? Wet?
Running from under the closet door. Sticky.
Ellen, don't. Don't touch it.
I had to. Jim, it's blood.
For Suspense, Roma Wines are bringing you Robert Taylor in The House in Cypress Canyon. Roma Wines' presentation tonight in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Between the acts of Suspense, this is Ken Niles for Roma Wines. These days before Christmas are busy ones indeed, yet smart hostesses everywhere find time for shopping and distinguished home entertaining later. The secret? Magnificent Grand Estate Wines. Presented by Roma, America's greatest vintner, Grand Estate Wines add distinction to your hospitality on a moment's notice. make your holiday welcome, effortless, and in perfect taste. The brilliant clarity, full fragrance, and mellow taste of Grand Estate wines please discriminating people everywhere. For Grand Estate wines, limited bottlings by Roma, are born of choicest grapes, then patiently guided to superb taste richness by Roma vintner skill, necessary time, and America's finest winemaking resources. Delight your guests with Grand Estate California wines for entertaining medium sherry, ruby port, or golden muscatel. For dining, burgundy or sauterne. So insist on Grand Estate wines and enjoy the crowning achievement of vintner skill.
This is Mr. Dark, and I wanted to tell you about Diabolique, the premier magazine of the horror genre. So for all of you fiends and gore hounds and darklings, whenever you need a fix of horror information, check out Diabolique, the premier magazine of the horror genre. This is Mr. Dark, and I wanted to tell you about California Costume Company. For all of your Halloween costume, check out California Costume Company, official sponsor of Mr. Dark's Video Nasty. Maybe you could get an animotion mask just like Mr. Dark, California Costume Company. Coming soon from HGB Entertainment, Herschel Gordon Lewis, the godfather of gore's new entry into his filmography, Blood Mania. From producer Jim Sato of Diabolique Films. You don't want to miss this horror anthology.
And now, Roma Wines bring back to our Hollywood soundstage Robert Taylor as James A. Woods, with Kathy Lewis as his wife Ellen, in the house in Cypress Canyon. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
It cannot be too difficult to understand from the foregoing why I've taken the pains to set down in writing the events related here. To find in one's newly rented house a closet which cannot be opened is in itself certainly no great cause for alarm. But to be awakened in the stillness of the night by unearthly cries within that house, to find oozing from under that closet door something that is unquestionably blood, that's another matter. Perhaps others might have been braver than we. Suffice it only to say that we got out of the house in something very close to a panic, and only returned when we had the moral support of two stalwart Los Angeles policemen.
You just moved in here, you say?
That's right, officer. You can see we're still unpacking.
And the place has been empty right along before that?
Yeah, I don't know much about that part of it. You could check all that with the real estate agent, though.
Well, where is this closet?
Oh, it's right in here, officer. And the blood is...
Where? Where's the blood?
Jim?
Officer, I swear to you, there was blood on the floor less than an hour ago. I saw it.
Uh-huh.
It was running out from under that door. We heard that noise, and we got up, and then we saw it. The door was locked.
Locked, huh?
Oh, no.
Well, it seems to be all right now.
Hey, you folks aren't trying to be funny, are you?
Isn't there anything in it?
No, ma'am, there is not.
Look, officer, we're reputable people. You can call my firm. They'll tell you all about me.
There's nothing wrong with this closet. Walls are solid. No trap doors.
If you think I'm lying...
I didn't say that, mister. Oh, you probably did hear some sort of a noise, and you got a little panicky and...
What about the blood? It got on my hand.
It isn't there now, is it?
Yes.
Where?
I feel it.
Now, you folks just take it easy. You know, you're liable to hear all kinds of noises up in these canyons at night. You're from the east, you say?
Yeah. I'm sorry, officer.
Ah, that's all right. That's all right. If you have any real trouble, call on us anytime.
All right.
Well, good night.
Good night.
Good night. Hey. You ought to have this door fixed. That's enough to scare you.
Yeah, we're going to have it fixed. Didn't say much about it after that. There wasn't much that could be said. The next day, I went down to a lot and bought a little Christmas tree and some trimmings, and we tried to pretend we were cheerful, but there was an uneasiness between us that had never been there before. Ellen seemed tired and listless. Several times during the day, I noticed her washing her hands with a brush, scrubbing the one that had touched the blood. That night, we each took a sleeping pill and went to bed. It was sometime after midnight when I was suddenly wide awake and staring into the darkness. In some way, I knew at once and instinctively what had awakened me. Ellen was not in her bed nor in the room. The nameless thing I feared gripped at my heart until I could scarcely breathe. I opened the bedroom door and started through the house, putting on every light that I could find. There was not much to search, but I searched thoroughly. The living room, the kitchen, bathroom, day, and even the garage. And all the time, the dread of looking where I knew at last I must look. For I think I knew from the very first time where I'd find her. It must have been a full minute that I stood before that closet door. Then I opened it. She stood there rigid, her arms at her sides, the fingers extended like claws. Her hair was over her face, her eyes stared out of it. Her lips were drawn back in a grin like an animal at bay. For a moment, I was frozen with the horror of it. I stretched out my hand. Very deliberately, she turned her head and sunk her teeth until they met into the flesh of my forearm. I'd raised my hand to strike at her, but already she'd relaxed her hold and gone utterly limp. She would have fallen unless I'd caught her. I carried her into the bedroom and laid her on the bed. Strangely, at that moment, my only thought was how I might revive her. Until I saw that it was not a faint, but a sleep that she'd fallen into. A sleep as deep and heavy as though she'd been drugged. And so I left her. But for me, that night, there was no sleep. Yes, Ellen?
Oh. What are you doing up so early?
Oh, I got a little restless. I'd make some coffee.
Oh, I had the most wonderful sleep. And I feel so rested.
Do you?
Mm-hmm. Jim.
What?
What's the matter with your arm?
Oh, I just hurt it.
Well, honey, it's terribly swollen. Let me see it.
No, it's all right, Ellen.
Oh, it isn't all right. You've got to see Dr. Wesley right away.
Sure, I will.
No,
I
now
will.
You promise me, Jim, that you'll go the first thing this morning. How'd it happen?
Why, there was a dog.
A dog?
Yeah, I heard him trying to chew through the screen door. I went out to chase him away, and he bit me.
Well, you mean there's all that racket, and I didn't even wake up?
No, Ellen, you didn't even wake up. It was clear to me that Ellen knew nothing of what had transpired the night before. I went to my office that morning and made a pretense of going over routine business, if only to restore my mind to some semblance of calm by the sight and sound of common, familiar things. Pain in my arm had become a persistent, dull throbbing. I made a late appointment with Dr. Wesley. He treated my arm with something of an arched eyebrow, and he said,
"Well, I've never seen anything quite like it before. That is, such a rapid onset of infection."
It was dark when I left his office. I hadn't realized it was so late. Driving home, my car seemed sluggish until I saw the needle on the dashboard and realized that I was pushing it to the utmost of its speed. That I was racing home to prevent something before it was too late, before the darkness had conspired against me. For somehow I already knew with certainty that it was the darkness and the night that I had to fear. The curves of the canyon seemed endless. And then the cold fear leaped up inside me. My house, too, was dark. I went slowly up the stone steps from the road, looking, praying for some sign of light or life. There was none. The house was empty. Ellen was gone. I looked with the same self-torturing thoroughness, and in that closet first of all, knowing as I did so that it was hopeless. So, alone in that empty house, I waited, powerless and helpless now, deadened in thought and will, empty as the house itself, save only for the overwhelming sense of a terrible foreboding. For some time in the early hours of the morning, I snapped on the radio, shortwave. Why? Surely a minor question now. I only know that I did. And then I heard it.
Car 58, car 58, go to Laurel Canyon, the 4,000 block. A report that a man has been injured or attacked. Condition thought to be critical. Ambulance will follow. That is all.
I was there almost before the police, edging my way through the little crowd, staring down at the man lying there in his white uniform under the streetlight.
Yeah, the milkman, poor guy.
I heard him scream, but when I got here, just like this, there's nothing
right,
on
stand
at all.
Stand back, stand back. Please, please stand back.
Well, you again.
I heard it on the radio. I live just down the road.
Yeah, I remember.
What happened?
Well, take a look. Maybe you can tell us.
He was dead. And he was lying on his back. And his throat had been torn out as though by the fangs of some wild animal. It is now Christmas Eve, or rather Christmas morning, for it's a little after midnight. I've been waiting here in the stillness of this empty house for nearly 24 hours, waiting for the end. Already once tonight, I've heard that dreadful wailing cry somewhere in the hills. I've nailed up the closet door, but that I know is childish, useless. My arm is horribly swollen and turning black, but that's nothing. It's another end that I foresee, as surely as other men foresee the rising of the sun. I hear the cry again. It's nearer now. I shall leave these notes in a sealed envelope and put it in a shoebox, in the hope that someone will give credence to these dark and terrible events, if indeed such nameless horrors can ever yield to mortal understanding. As for myself, I feel no longer any fear or even sorrow, only a desire that the end and the thing that I must do may come soon. And it will be soon, I know. Yes, for there is someone at the door.
Someone at the door. What do you make of it, Sam?
It's quite a yarn. But what of it?
That's what I thought. Now listen, that's not quite all of it. Huh? Clip to it's a newspaper clipping. Listen. Hollywood, December the 26th. Police reported what was apparently a case of murder and suicide in Cypress Canyon sometime in the early hours of the morning. The victims were James A. Woods, a chemical engineer, and his wife, Ellen. Preliminary investigation indicates that Mrs. Woods was killed by the blast of a shotgun in the hands of her husband, who then turned the weapon upon himself. That she fought desperately for her life, however, was evidenced by the disorder of the room and the severe lacerations inflicted upon her husband about the neck and arms. This is the second tragedy to be reported in Cypress Canyon within 24 hours, the other being the unexplained death of Frank Polanski, a milkman.
Well, no such murders or whatever they were ever occurred, if that's what's worrying you. The clipping, well, have those things printed up, you know.
No, it's not that, Sam. That story was found in an unfinished house in Cypress Canyon. No number, no nothing, just a framework.
Uh-huh.
Now that house is finished. When I drove by it today, but that's what stopped me, Sam, because it all fits. Now that it's finished, it is the house in the story, the same construction, the same vines and creepers on the lawn, even the same number.
So what, a guy who knows roughly what this house is going to be like writes a yarn and loses it or something?
Did he know the place was going to be listed for rental today, the Saturday before Christmas?
Oh, Jerry, coincidence. Two bits you find the guy next door is a ghost story writer or something, and he's been wondering for a year what happened to that thing he wrote.
Okay, coincidence. Well, I'm sorry I bothered you, Sam.
Don't be silly. I liked it. It's a good yarn. That the for rent sign you were talking about?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to put it up outside now.
Uh-huh. Well, so long, Jerry, and Merry Christmas again.
Yeah, well, thanks, Sam. I guess I was kind of silly, all right, huh?
Listen, when a guy named, whatever it is, Woods, with a wife named Ellen, comes in to rent that place from you, then you can start worrying.
Yeah. Well, so long, Sam.
So long, Jerry.
Come in.
Oh, we're sorry to bother you, but we just happened to see that for rent sign outside.
Well, yeah, I hung it out just this minute.
Is the house available?
Oh, sure it is.
Let me introduce myself. My name is James A. Woods, and this is my wife, Ellen.
How do? Wow. Looks like it's fixing to...
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Suspense.
Presented by Roma Wines, R-O-M-A, Roma Wines, selected for your pleasure from the world's greatest reserves of fine wines. Tonight's show marks the third birthday of Suspense on the air, and this is Ken Niles asking our star of the evening, Robert Taylor, to help us celebrate.
Why didn't you tell me before, Ken? If I'd only known, I'd have baked a cake.
Well, Bob, all Suspense parties are surprise parties. As an old hand on Suspense, you know that in our plays, the tables are usually turned on the star. So tonight, although it's our birthday, we're going to give you a present. Here it is, a gift basket of Grand Estate California wines from Roma, America's greatest vintner, to our distinguished anniversary guest, Robert Taylor.
Thanks, Ken. You turn a nice table.
And you can set a nice table with Grand Estate Burgundy in your basket, Bob. For Grand Estate Burgundy means rare dining pleasure. Adds memorable distinction to holiday dinner. Even everyday meals are outstanding in taste when Grand Estate Burgundy is served. Yes, all Grand Estate wines presented by Roma are limited bottlings of outstanding taste excellence.
Well, that I know about Grand Estate wines, Ken.
But did you know that for Grand Estate wines, Roma selects only the choicest grapes? Then the ancient skill of Roma master vintners, necessary time, and America's finest winemaking resources guide the cuvee of this grape treasure to rich taste luxury.
Greetings, Darklings. This is Mr. Dark, and I wanted to let you know about Death Rock Radio. So when you can't get enough of all of your favorite goth and dark wave and death rock, punk, psychobilly classics, then you might need to tune in to Death Rock Radio. Check out all of the great DJs. And yours truly is one of them. Special Mr. Dark's Audio Nasty Show, last Sunday of every month on DeathRockRadio.com. Check it out.
This is Mr. Dark, and I wanted to tell you about Diabolique, the premier magazine of the horror genre. So for all of you fiends and gore hounds and darklings, whenever you need a fix of horror information, check out Diabolique, the premier magazine of the horror genre.
This is Mr. Dark, and on this episode of the Audio Nasty, I have a true pioneer of the film industry. He has been rightfully called the godfather of gore and can be credited with starting the splatter genre with his cult hits Blood Feast, 2000 Maniacs, The Wizard of Gore, and others. He's branched off into exploitation films, juvenile delinquent films, and even a couple of children's films and a comedy. He raised the bar by going farther than anyone else that has ever dared. So with that introduction, I want to welcome on the show Mr. Herschel Gordon Lewis and Mr. Jim Sato, the producer of the new Herschel Gordon Lewis film, Blood Mania.
Hello.
We are honored to be here.
So Mr. Lewis and Mr. Sato, there are many things our listeners would like to know. How was this film conceived and when did it start?
You want going to- way, what, let's go back in history. For the independent filmmaker, a problem existed from the beginning and exists even more so today, and that is, how does one gain attention, or in those ancient times, playing time in theaters, against some of the mighty arm wrestling that the major film companies could afford, and we couldn't. One night, I was lying there brooding over this, and on came a movie on TV, some old detective story, in which they were chasing this gangster, and they shot him full of bullet holes, and he died very peacefully with a little splotch on his shirt. And I said, wait a minute, that's not right. And that gave me the idea for going over the top, because at the time, there were regulations against nudity, but there were no regulations against this kind of violence. And I thought maybe if we go far enough, there will be some brave theaters who will show it, and there will be some brave theater goers who will look at it. The next step was what do we shoot? We were staying at a little motel in Miami Beach, on the North Beach, called the Suez Motel. And the reason we were staying there is because it was the cheapest place on the beach. Outside the Suez Motel was a Sphinx. Now, you may have been to Giza, Egypt, as I have. There's a Sphinx there that's about 200 feet tall. The Sphinx outside the Suez was about 8 feet tall, but a Sphinx is a Sphinx shot against the sun. And that gave me the notion for an Egyptian overtone to this thing. And the most Egyptian name I could think of was Fuad Ramses. And so the anti-hero of Blood Feast became Fuad Ramses. People ask me who wrote the script for Blood Feast, and my answer usually is, what's that? Because we pretty much made this thing up as we went along. And as I was cutting it in my little cutting room in Chicago later on, people would look at this piece of film with grease pencil marks all over it and say, oh, is that a medical film? And I said, we're cooked. So I figure we'll open the film in Peoria. If we die in Peoria, who will know? We not only weren't cooked, we were the cookers. To this day, looking back at it, I remember how stunned I was at the business this piece of, I'll call it a piece of crap, was in attracting theater goers who didn't say, hey, that's a ragged pan, or why didn't they ever do this, or oh, did you notice the lighting, how primitive it is? And instead, they would say, did you see that? And that really established a different category of motion picture, which today has expanded so that splatter films are simply part of the mix that one sees today. And I guess I proved that if you live long enough, you become legitimate.
So now, yes. If we skip ahead, some decades, Herschel and I met at a horror convention and spoke quite frequently prior to it, and decided that making a film together might be a good idea. So we ended up wanting to shoot one of Herschel's scripts, and for various reasons that didn't work out. I went to see Raven Banner Entertainment will play a film in theaters across North America for one evening only, so I thought I'd go and see Slash from Guns N' Roses' directorial debut. And before the film started, they played this short film, and I can't recall what it was, but it was, well, frankly, terrible. And I was sitting in the theater, and I thought to myself, a person has to be able to do better than that. And the idea of doing an anthology kind of cemented itself in my head. And I'd grown up watching Amicus films, the great horror anthologies from Amicus, Vault of Horror, that sort of thing. So that evening I went home and I laid in bed, and an idea came to me for a script. And I had a director and a star in mind. Who she was isn't important at this point, but I sat up in bed and I started just writing out the salient points of the script. So I called Herschel and I said, let's do an anthology. And that's what we ended up doing for Blood Mania.
So how much of it was collaborative?
Totally. Jim is a pleasure to work with. I'll tell you why. He has a very rare trait in our business, and that's the ability to recognize before it happens what might happen. So he's pretty much a mind reader in that respect. And in all the movies I've made over the years, I've never had such a good time. That's a factor, too. Imagine doing what you love to do and having a good time doing it, and I thank you, Jim, for that.
Oh, well, the pleasure's all mine, sir. Trust me.
So I do.
End in post-production before introducing Blood Mania to the world, and are there any rules that you follow, or does it vary from film to film?
Well, we're still in post-production, actually. There's still editing that we're doing in Calgary, Canada, and New York. There's a few special surprises that I'm trying to line up for fans in terms of who might appear musically on the in the film. So you know there's that, and the film does contain Easter eggs and surprises for longtime fans of Mr. Lewis.
And we're talking about, in fact, already the possibility of making another one, because I think Jim had a good time too.
Oh yeah.
When two guys like us have a good time, it's time to have another good time.
Well, I agree. Do you remember any art or books that you're reading or films that you're watching, etc., that might have influenced you while you're working on the screenplay?
You mean of this one?
Yes, sir.
Of the new movie. Jim can answer that better than I can.
Well, not as such. I mean, my influences in horror, if you look at books, come from Richard Lehman, Jack Ketchum. So I've always been heavily into the gore aspect of things. In fact, I'm trying to get a hold of the Lehman estate and Mr. Ketchum, who so far has alluded me, to maybe see what I can do to gain some rights to some of their stories for future anthologies.
You mean Jack Ketchum?
Jack Ketchum.
Absolutely, he's one of the greats for sure.
It's funny, when I was in college, I was reading Off Season, and it was the most gory, visceral book that I've ever read up to that point. And I said to myself, "Wow, I'd love to make this into a movie someday." And there's only one man who can direct it, and that would be Herschel Gordon Lewis. And that was longer ago than I even care to admit, but. Yeah, so, you know, there's certain things that I would like to see. Whether or not they're realistic or not, or, you know, as time will tell.
And now for an important question. Is this a funny film?
Yes and no. How's that for an answer?
Yeah,
it reminds me of a joke they tell about the fellow who went out with a pair of Siamese twins. And his friend said, "You have a good time?" He said, "Well, yes and no." One benefit we have from what we've done here, with four separate episodes in this movie, some are funny, some are grotesque, some are very dark. We have something for everybody in this movie. So no one can screen this thing and say, "I missed what I like." We're also trying to convert some tastes here, where we're not making what people expect to see. That's a factor, too. And that may, in fact, move this whole genre of motion picture a different notch, laterally, but it'll move it.
Yeah, when I was going through scripts and that sort of thing, and we went through a lot of them, a lot of different writers, a lot of different screenplays, and finally settled on the ones that we wanted. We have a healthy mix of comedy. Basically, we have one segment that Mr. Lewis wrote. That's sort of the best way I can describe it. It's a Wile E. Coyote cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hilarious. Another is an homage to the 80s slasher films, and I think people have seen the sneak peek of that, called Gorgeous, about an 80s tribute band who run into some trouble. And it's very funny. The screenplay was written by a very talented young screenwriter named Kevin Littlelight. It contains a lot of gore and a lot of humor. The third one is a downright creature tale. And the fourth one is very gory psychological horror. So we've got something for every... And I think there's some marketing that goes into that as well, because, you know, the thing with an anthology is if you like three of them and you don't like one, you're probably still likely to buy yourself a DVD or download it or, you know, do that sort of thing. So
yes, we hedged our bet on this one.
So what is American about this film?
Well, the film takes place in a... even though it was shot in Canada using a Canadian crew and Canadian actors, which I managed to get, you know, some very, very talented people whose work you've seen on, oh, Fargo or Hell on Wheels, Interstellar. Some of the crew that we used are working on The Revenant right now. Which they're back filming here in Calgary with Leonardo DiCaprio and the Academy Award-winning director. But what's American about it is it all takes place in a small fictional town called Louisville. And all subsequent sequels, all the stories take place in Louisville. And, you know, I mean, certain parts of Calgary look like small-town America, so we took advantage of that. Oh, and there's some guns.
That helps. Also, the dialogue is peculiarly American. That is, we deal in argot, not necessarily in proper grammar. It's the way people walk and talk in America. And the differential between Canada and the United States is a positive one for Canada. I don't think I've ever worked with a more enthusiastic bunch who are really a more talented group of technicians who, like Jim, they know what I want before I even want it. And I'm looking forward with great eagerness to doing this again with these guys.
Well, that, I would say, is a certainty. As the Vice President of Development and Production for Diabolique Films, which is a division of Diabolique Magazine, I have to decide whether or not I want to go strictly like Amicus Films did and do just anthologies, or whether I'm going to throw features into the mix. And I have some scripts for features that I would love to do, and a lot of it just depends on whether or not it works out in terms of the logistics, the Hollywood logistics of things. When you have one successful venture, then everything becomes easier. And one of the advantages of filming in Calgary is, of course, that we do have access to all sorts of government grants and that sort of thing. So rest assured, Diabolique Films and HGB Entertainment Limited will have not only more Herschel Gordon Lewis, but I think we will have some quality horror features down the road.
I can say that Herschel Gordon Lewis has definitely been an influence on me and many others in the, you know, horror genre and everything. I mean, I was running around making guts and everything with strawberry preserves when I was a little kid after watching Blood Feast.
How did your parents allow you to see that movie? In fact, why did your parents want to see it themselves?
Well, they didn't watch it. I watched it in another room. And what it was I was obsessed with, like, Tom Savini and, like, gore movies and stuff, and I wanted to be a special effects artist. So they let me watch all these movies because that was, to me, it's just art. It's not real. You know what I mean? It's just a fake form of entertainment with everything and everything. And to me, it's just a form of art to where you're trying to make something look as real as possible for, you know, grotesque factors or whatever. But, you know, it was definitely an influence on me, along with Tom Savini and many others. But
yeah, I have to say,
you say that. I'll tell you why I'm pleased to hear you say that. Because many people in our industry, when we first started making this kind of movie, thought that we were outlaws. How dare they do this? Despite the fact that some of the major company product I felt was inferior in terms of motivating somebody who looked at it to say to somebody else, you should be seeing this. which is the ultimate compliment any movie can have. One proof we have offered, which I think may have been the way in which we changed the course of motion pictures forever, is the recognition that showmanship is a very good substitute for dollars. And in doing that, I think also we have become legitimate to a point where no one expected that to happen after Blood Feast.
Well, I think that mentality is why you've progressed and sustained your reputation, everything over the years, and it sets you apart. It's definitely one of the factors that sets you apart from many of the others. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, and just so you know, all the gore effects in this film are practical.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and that's another factor too. When we made Blood Feast, none of this existed. I had to use department store mannequins. That's all that were available. Today you can walk into any magic shop and get arms that bend and fingers that curl. You can get stage blood that doesn't, it's not just a kaopectate and water. The improvement in this, I'll take some responsibility for. In fact, I wish I could get some royalties for, because now an effect is a much more realistic effect than we had in Blood Feast. And yet, the peculiarity of all this is that despite its primitive nature, Blood Feast today, all these years later, it still shows. People are still responding to it. And here are some of these movies that cost $100 million or more to make, and they strut and frit their hour upon the stage for a couple of weeks, and then they're gone forever. Blood Feast is not gone forever. It's been there forever. And to me, that is really the ultimate compliment, along with what you guys are saying.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm excited to see Blood Mania, of course. I mean, I got the sneak peek up on my website and everything and on YouTube. But I'm, like, really excited to see it, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Well, we're working on our main trailer now, and we'll release it to the world soon. I think it's going to be a treat for Mr. Lewis's fans, for fans of the gore genre. Although I will say that we did, one of the principles behind each story is that, okay, there has to be Mr. Lewis's type gore, but the gore isn't, it's not first and foremost. What we decided on first is that we have to have a story, a good story. And the blood becomes secondary to that, which isn't to say that, you know, it's not going to please gore hounds, because I think we used, what, 15 gallons of blood, fake blood, in this film?
Yeah, and that was just our dinner.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it's gory, but I think people will be entertained. And that's something that sorely lacks in a lot of independent gore films, where it's for gore's sake.
We have not fallen into that trap. But on that point, I would tell you, Mr. Dark, that Jim has an effects team there that absolutely could compete with any effects team, regardless of where they are, who they are, how much they cost. It was astounding to me. And when you see this movie, you will understand how far the industry has come in the hands of a producer like Jim Sato.
Wow. Well, you're setting me up here, Virgil, for a big failure. But, no, part of the fun for me was I got to be involved in the gore as a gore supervisor.
That's a good title.
That's a good title. Yeah, it's better than the one we gave Seymour Sheldon. But but to actually get involved and to be doing this is like a dream come true. We did a couple of shots where even our special effects guy and Dave Trainer is our special effects specialist, and he's worked on like Blade 2 and Tucker and Dale versus Evil. He does the effects for Fargo and Hell on Wheels, that sort of thing. And we did one effect. We recreated an effect from a movie from the 80s as an homage. And he was like a little kid. Like, he's going, oh, this is Savini, old school shit, I love this, you know, and he was just excited like a little boy. But the true test is when we... I can't describe what we did precisely, but we had a three-camera setup. And when the result of what we did happened, when you're watching the dailies, each camera operator, you could hear them going, oh, shit. Oh, oh, man. And when you hear people moaning because the gore is happening in the background sound, you know you're doing something effective. So judging upon that, I think we're ahead of the game.
I do have one more question for Herschel. And when you made Blood Feast, like when it first came out, did you get a lot of flack for that, since it was such a groundbreaking film at the time?
My goodness, yes. In fact, we began to welcome it, because the more the critics lambasted this movie, and they did, and it's understandable because critics judge a movie by a different set of standards from the typical theater goer, and we were getting editorials in newspapers lambasting us. I'll give you a perfect example. From a town called San Diego in California, apparently the newspaper there had run a negative story about Blood Feast. And we got a bunch of mail on the same day criticizing us. And the reason we knew it was organized is because all these letters, and they were in letter form, were addressed, said, called us, "You reckless men," and they spelled reckless, W-R-E-C-K-L-E-S-S, which I thought was funny. My partner at the time, Dave Friedman, didn't think it was funny because some of them made physical threats. So he went to the FBI with those, and they, fortunately, they thought it was funny, too. But yes, we certainly could not ever be accused of making a movie the critics liked. Obviously, too, many religious organizations jumped on the bandwagon. But what we recognized early on, and we weren't the first to recognize this syndrome, the more something gets attacked, the more attention goes to it. And I don't know that Blood Feast would have survived the way it did, or the many movies I've made since then would have even been possible had we not come under attack. The very nature of that, instead of working negatively, worked positively.
That's absolutely correct. And what would your advice be to artists today that are doing something similar in those type of regards? Like, what would your advice be for somebody that's like breaking the grounds and getting all this flack from everybody?
My advice to some would-be filmmaker who was entering our dark, that's a good word, our dark type of enterprise, is number one, don't let your ego show. Too many, and I get these scripts just as Jim does, telling me telling me in advance how brilliant the script is, and invariably it isn't. Don't try to shoot a movie with your friends on a handheld digital camera. That's not professional. Think in terms of someone who does not know what a genius you are and who might react to scenes and conversations that they may not hear anywhere else. Think in terms of exploitation. How are you going to sell this movie after you've shot it? Because once again, I've been on a set where they finished shooting and they had big parties, and wow, they're just getting started at that point. What matters is not what you like. And I'm saying this to anybody and everybody who wants to make a movie. What matters is being able to understand what people who don't know you will like.
Power Records presents The Curse of the Werewolf. Even a man who's pure of heart and says his prayers at night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the moon is full and bright.
The words seemed to echo in my skull. I struggled with something snarling and vicious within my soul. And when the madness passed...
You! Hold it right there!
What in the name of... Good Lord!
The man I'd attacked was dead.
Some sort of animal. But Lord, the way it runs, like a man.
There was a bridge, a muddy river. I dived in, my shoulder afire with the agony of a glancing bullet. My arm. Somehow I got away. Where am I? How did I get here? What is this place? I ran. Under the light of the bright full moon, I ran. I must find my way home. Why am I here? Why? My skin is burning. My thoughts unclear. Why am I here? But the night gave me no answer, and I felt my dark dream slipping, and in a moment, I awoke. No! What? I'm home again. That dream. Each time I have it, the dream grows worse. It almost seemed real. Today, I'm a full-fledged 18 years old. My arm was slashed, just as it had been cut in the dream by a policeman's bullet. Suddenly, it all came flooding back. That dream. Was it a dream? Lord, what if it was real?
Jack, it's almost time for breakfast.
Yeah, I know, Mom. I guess I don't feel very hungry. Maybe I'll just rest in my room today and think. I had plenty to think about. I didn't know what was bothering me exactly. When evening came, I headed for a lonely stretch of beach. I felt myself fall forward. My vision blurred, and when it cleared, I saw a thing that made me scream. My hand! And in the sudden brilliance of unclouded moonlight, in the reflection of a muddy pool, I saw him for the first time. And I knew! I was a werewolf. I have no way of knowing how I spent those hours before dawn. I must have wandered until the beast who was myself died. When morning came...
Jack! Lord, where have you been? We've been searching for you everywhere. Jack!
I heard my stepfather's words only dimly.
Can you walk? Try to get your feet. Lisa, fix him some coffee.
Yes, coffee.
I'm okay, Dad. I'm okay. The house was warm. Lisa, you're crying. What's wrong?
She can't answer you, Jack.
What? Why not?
Your sister's almost hysterical.
Dad, tell me, please. What's happening?
Tell you? If you'd been here, you'd know. Your mother was almost killed tonight, Jack. She's lucky to be alive. Something went wrong with the brakes of her car. She was searching for you, Jack.
Searching for me? Then she must have known. And now she may be dying. And it's my fault. All mine.
That's one way to see it, son.
Please, Mr. Russell, the boy's upset. Let me be with him alone.
I wish I could have said something to Dr. Allen.
You're mighty tense, lad. You can't blame yourself, you know.
I can't? Just watch me, Doc. He gave me a shot. Something to relax me, he said. Just as he was leaving, I heard the phone.
Yes, this is Mr. Russell. Unchanged? Yes, I see. But if Mrs. Russell should awaken, please tell her we've found Jack.
And then it all faded, melting into black. And when I woke, it was mid-afternoon.
Mom! Lord, how could I sleep while she... I'd better get down to the hospital, find out how she is.
Mrs. Russell? Sorry, son, she's on the critical list. That means no one can see her. No one.
Sure, thanks.
Somehow I've got to find out where she is. The doctor over there, talking about Mom. That must be her room. I'll just wait, and then... Lord!
Jack? Is it you?
Yeah, Mom. It's me, the professional prodigal son.
What's this? Please, try a smile for Mom.
Sure, Mom.
Jack, stop feeling so sorry for yourself. Your father would be ashamed, but you never knew what kind of a man he really was.
Mom.
Don't stop me, Jack. I won't be stopped. This is a part of your heritage I always ignored, pretended didn't exist. But now I'm dying, and you have to be told.
Come on, Mom, don't say that. You live longer than me.
Jack, you don't understand. I've done you a terrible wrong. I've given you a curse. One that will live with you forever.
A curse? I...
Don't understand. How could you? Your father was a fine man. A man I met in a small Baltic state while just a student on a holiday abroad. A man I married and bore a son.
Ah, Jacob, you're a big lad, eh? Big like your father, bright like your mother.
Those first 2 years were idyllic. Yet even then I could sense some dark secret that stood between us, a secret that blossomed like some wicked fruit once a month, when he would lock himself in the single musty tower and remain there for 3 days and 3 nights. He told me he studied his books on those nights, and for 2 years I tried to believe him, until that night of the storm, when a bolt of lightning tore out the tower's side. Later that same night, in the village below, the village carpenter made his way homeward through the street.
Who's... No!
But he never made it home again.
Aye, my lady. We need the Baron's aid, we do.
Everybody knows he's the most educated man in all the land.
Why, he's upstairs in the tower. This way, gentlemen. But he wasn't there, Jack.
Gone!
The demon must have taken the Baron, too.
But on the following night, as the townspeople hunted in the northern woods...
Here, in the shadows... Something moved.
Not just something, Jack. But the hideously deformed caricature of the man those peasants dared call...
Werewolf.
Though I wasn't there, I could hear the sound of them shooting silver bullets. I can hear that pitiful monster's cry every night, every moment I try to dream. For you see, the men came to me later and told me the horrible secret they'd uncovered.
It's him. Lord, it's the Baron.
My father... A werewolf? And maybe that explains it all.
How could I have told you, Jack? I'd read the family books. Knew it was an hereditary curse. One that you may well have been damned with. You, or even little Lissa.
And the curse?
To become a man like beast. First on the night of your 18th year. Forevermore, whenever the full moon blooms.
Well, Mother... You might as well know what you've probably already guessed. The curse is mine. But why did it happen to our family? Why us? I could stay there no longer. I have to get away.
Jack!
Blackness blistered inside of me. All I could see was the moon. The moon. Something boiled up within me. An unearthly force tore my mind apart. I was changing into a werewolf once more. As my human mind slipped away, I felt the horror. A horror I would have to live with my whole life. Unless I could find out what had caused the curse. Perhaps then there would be a way out. Would a journey to my father's homeland bring the answers?
20 hours later, and across the large expanse of Transylvania...
This is it, Topaz. Rusoff Manor. Among these old books, we're bound to find some of the answers. God knows, maybe all.
Jack, come here. I think I've found it.
Yes. This is exactly what I've been searching for, Topaz. Here, read this. How my great-great-great-grandfather became the werewolf. It began in 1795. That's a long time ago. Into the night, I read the diary. Words penned by the first member of my family to be stricken by the curse. How I survived this past week, I shall never know. It began... But I now fear the coming of each night.
Each full moon for the horrors that it brings me. It began 1 week before, and when it shall end, I fear I will never know.
Baron Rusoff, I am sorry, but your wife, she's been slain by the vampire.
Louisa killed? By Dracula? He threatened if I did not kneel to his power that I would suffer. I must slay him. Gustav. Lay my wife to rest. I have work that must be done. I go to kill the demon. Castle Dracula was unguarded, for there were none in the village below who would have dared venture towards it save I. And so, making my entrance to the fiend's underground chambers was done with ease. You sleep in comfort, do you, Dracula? Then sleep tightly, dark beast, for you shall never waken again. Dracula screamed as the wooden stake stabbed through his heart. But his scream lasted only one short, breathed moment. For in an instant, there were only ashes where flesh had once been. At through his coffin in the cold Danube waters below, I thought revenge had been mine. Then I heard a muffled sound, a cry, and heaven help my foolish curiosity, I turned to its source. There was a door sealed with a wooden beam, and idiot that I was, I opened it to find a girl? Who are you, lass? And why are you imprisoned in this living hell?
I am called Lydia, sir. And it was Dracula who placed me here.
Damn devil! How long have you been here, girl?
1 month, sir. And kept alive only as long as my blood pleased him.
Live in fear no longer, Lydia. The fiend is dead. We walked beneath the moon and I talked. But my conversation was the last thing she cared about. For as the full silvered moon loomed above us, I heard a fierce, slavering growl. A wail from a being, neither human nor animal. And when I turned towards it, I saw the face of my death. Her claws glistened in the moonlight, but it was her eyes that transfixed and paralyzed me as my murderer sank her fangs into my neck. And from that moment on, I was cursed.
And for the next two nights, beneath the rising full moon, I became a mindless, rampaging werewolf. There's more to read, but not now.
But why did Dracula keep a werewolf locked away? What could he fear from it?
The diary said Dracula could not control the beast as he was able to control others. That there was something about her that made her impervious to his commands. Which probably means that Dracula's command won't affect me. And that I'll be the one who'll be able to stop him. Maybe that's it, Topaz. Maybe if I can defeat Dracula, the curse of the werewolf will be broken.
You must be careful, Jack. Dracula is very powerful.
Looks like I'm going to have company tonight.
Unexpected company. I see those two young fools from Rosov Manor wish to enter my castle. Good. Very good indeed.
Dracula leaps from the tower roof and flies once again as the raven-winged bat.
Topaz, run! It's Dracula attacking!
But before the girl can move...
Topaz! Good Lord, he's taken her. I'll find you, Topaz! That I swear!
As Jack Russell scales the peak to Castle Dracula, he is bathed in the light of the full moon, and Jack Russell once again becomes the werewolf. However, inside the castle...
My dear young lady, welcome to my castle. I hope you will enjoy my hospitality.
Suddenly, he hears the harsh, guttural growling of the werewolf.
What? A beast attacks here in my castle? Now he shall finally perish!
The battle begins. Dracula commands the beast to stop, to halt. But this is a new breed of beast. It attacks. Dracula's orders affect it not, for the werewolf bites its ivory fangs deeper and deeper into Dracula's neck. Until Dracula turns, his face burning with bloodthirsty rage, and leaps at the werewolf's throat. Back and forth they writhe in deadly combat. And soon it's obvious, neither can win, but neither will lose.
Fight well, werewolf. Take the girl and go, and pray that we never meet again. For the next time, I will not be so kind. Until the next time...
With that, the bat that once was Dracula rises into the night, and the curse of the werewolf remains bloodied, but unbroken.